Rutledge. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. We are now ready to proceed with the argument on 97-3452W, State X Rel J.H. Findorf and Son versus the Circuit Court for Milwaukee County. Representing J.H. Findorf is Michael B. Van Sicklin. Mr. Van Sicklin.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mike Van Sicklin, a partner in the Madison office of Foley & Lardner. It's my pleasure this morning to represent the petitioner, J.H. Findorf & Son, Inc. To your far right is my colleague, Mike Heffernan, who's helped me on the brief, and next to him is the chief financial officer of Findorf, Dan Peterson. This case presents two issues regarding post-appeal judicial substitution. The first issue is whether the chief judge in a circuit court has the right to review and overrule the trial court's initial granting of a request for judicial substitution. The second issue is whether Findorf here was entitled to have its request for judicial substitution honored following its successful appeal, where the Court of Appeals, an underlying case, on remand, reversed and remanded with directions that required further proceedings. I'd like to address the chief judge issue first, and probably more briefly, because I think that issue does lead to an interesting question of the proper standard of review here today, and is, I think, arguably dispositive of the whole case if the court agrees with our position that the chief judge does not have the authority to review and overrule a trial court's granting of a request for substitution. Now
should you succeed or should you not succeed? Either way, let's say you don't succeed, to whom would this case go? Is Judge Hayes still on that rotation?
He's actually been rotated out of the civil area to the family area, is my understanding, Your Honor. I think under the Milwaukee rules, though, the chief judge had reassigned the case to him in any event. So I assume it would go to him under the rules, you think? That's my understanding. I'll go through briefly the very kind of unusual procedural facts here, because it does, I think, lead into the question of what was the chief judge's authority to do what he did here. Following the remitter, we filed a timely request in proper form to Judge Hayes for judicial substitution. He promptly granted that request and sent it on to the chief judge of Milwaukee County, Judge Sheedy. He approved the substitution and reassigned the case to Judge Wells in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. Judge Wells evidently then, on his own, protested at Chief Judge Sheedy and requested that he not take the case. It's not clear what his reasoning was, but it went back to Chief Judge Sheedy, who then reversed himself and reversed Judge Hayes' decision and sent the whole matter back to Judge Hayes, the trial court who had originally handled the case. And at that point, Findorf, I got notice of it, protested. We had a telephonic hearing with the chief judge, and at that point, the chief judge reaffirmed his decision to reverse Judge Hayes and to leave the case on remand with Judge Hayes. At that point, we filed a request for a writ to the Court of Appeals and went back to Judge Hayes and got a stay pending the appeal. Judge Hayes reaffirmed that stay when we got to this court's level, and so the case on the merits has been stayed ever since. Judge Hayes found that we had a substantial likelihood of success on appeal on the issue of substitution, and here we are. Now, the chief judge...
Could I ask you a question? Is it absolutely beyond dispute that Judge Hayes granted the motion for substitution?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And that's reflected in the transcript of Judge Sheedy's telephonic hearing, which is at the end of our appendix. And it's also reflected in the minutes of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, which are part of our appendix. He signed the request and sent it on to the chief judge.
Now, if I may, you had a hearing in front of Judge Sheedy, ultimately, and I don't recall reading in that hearing that Judge Sheedy acknowledged that Judge Hayes had granted the motion for substitution.
You're right, Your Honor. Now I think about it. What happened was we initially got a notice of scheduling from Judge Wells, and it said the case has been reassigned to Judge Wells. Thereafter, we got another notice saying, no, there's a scheduling conference in front of Judge Hayes. Judge Hayes called us up and tried to have a scheduling conference. We protested saying we had filed the request. What happened? He said, I granted the request, but it's come back to me. And at that point, we wound up in front of the chief judge with a telephonic hearing. And so we ended up supplementing our petition for review, our writ, to the Court of Appeals to raise this issue.
The question you raised is that whether a chief judge, after the trial judge has acted, can reverse that ruling. My question would be, and basically I think I appreciate that position. The question is, if it's obvious that the trial judge has, for whatever reason, and we won't say it's this case, but in another case has made an error, are you saying that the chief judge then is, even in that case, without the power to reverse that ruling? Let's say it's clearly not timely, clearly. But the trial judge says, oh, yes, it is timely. I'm out of here. Are you saying in that instance that the chief judge could not act?
That's our position, Your Honor. And
so once the trial judge has acted, regardless of whether it is an appropriate ruling, the chief judge is not able to act.
I think there's other ways in which the aggrieved party in that situation can seek review. And that's exactly what happened in the Ruzulowski case. The trial court granted the substitution request, and the party which had lost the appeal that wanted to keep the same judge appealed to the Court of Appeals. You could do it by, you know, the interlocutory appeal route or by the writ route. And I think to do otherwise, Your Honor, creates a slippery slope here of when the chief judge can intervene in the trial court's decision-making. Can the chief judge second-guess a trial court on a question of venue or jurisdiction or scheduling or mode of trial? In the statutes, there's a very express grant to a chief judge where there's a party initiative requesting review to get involved. But that only exists under the statute where the trial court has denied the request. And that's based upon the policy that the Court of Appeals has acknowledged in the Ullman case exists in favor of broad, unqualified substitution on remand. It doesn't mean that where a statute grants an express right, that there isn't, where it doesn't, you know, extend over to the other situation, which we have here, the granting of a substitution request, that a chief judge on his own, without any request of a party, can second guess that decision. Now,
let me play the other side of that. Well, why, it may not be set forth in the statute, but look, the chief judge has general administrative powers, and why not allow the chief judge under general administrative powers to administrate what he or she is supposed to do?
I think there's a difference between administering and the type of decision-making that occurred here. The party, my client here, has a right, an unqualified right, to get a new judge that's not invested in trying to protect his former decision on the remand. And to take away that right under the guise of being a general administrative power, I think, goes too far. This court's rules at 70:19 and 21 deal with the chief judge's administrative powers. Under 70:21 sub 26, it specifically deals with this issue. It says the chief judge has power or authority to address the substitution request under the rule, which is 801.58 sub 2, which expressly is limited to reviewing, where a party requests it, the denial of a substitution request.
I'm wondering if a case that we decided, I think last year, no, how time flies, a couple of years ago, the James L.J. case, has any involvement in this issue. In that case, There was a question as to whether or not the appeal of the Chief Judge's determination on substitution only would lie with the Supreme Court, or could it go to the Court of Appeals? And we found that it could go to the Court of Appeals. And we said that the exercise of the statutory right to substitution in any particular case raises a question of law rather than a question of court administration. And because it's a question of law, not administration, it goes to the Court of Appeals. That's what we... Does that have any implication in this argument that you're making now?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the position we're taking is consistent with that holding. That is, if a party is aggrieved by a decision of a trial court to grant substitution, feels that the request was untimely or in the wrong form or whatever, they have the right to seek review in the Court of Appeals. And I think that's the proper step to take.
Well, I don't disagree with you. It's consistent. In fact, that's why I ask you. I mean, I think it's very consistent. It's case law that supports your argument. I mean, that's
and I think otherwise makes bad policy, because if we encourage these chief judges to take a very broad view of their administrative powers, what's to stop them from second-guessing trial courts and other types of decisions involving a venue decision, mode of trial, et cetera, because there really isn't a whole lot of difference here. And I think that goes too far. So our first issue, I think, is that Chief Judge Sheedy, without any request from anybody here, should not have reversed Judge Hayes's decision granting substitution. If this court agrees, I think that's dispositive. Now, I would like to turn to...
I think you said without a request from anybody. I mean, were you not the party that wanted this brought before Judge Sheedy?
Well, I mean, I'll backtrack, Your Honor. We requested substitution of Judge Hayes. That happened. It was the new judge to whom Judge Sheedy assigned the case who evidently protested to the chief judge. And at that point, the chief judge reversed himself and sent it back to Judge Hayes. When we discovered that, when Judge Hayes tried to have a scheduling conference with me and I protested, he said, "Well, go back in front of Judge Sheedy and deal with it." And we ended up in the Court of Appeals on the issue. So it was never the other side, Trenco Electric, in our underlying case, who said, "Chief Judge, we want to seek review of Judge Hayes's decision granting the substitution request of Findor." That's not how the question unfolded.
I know this gets into the other issue, and I don't want to jump ahead, except the chief judge, being the administrative head of that district, looks at a lot of different things, and I think one of the things that Chief Judge Sheedy looked at was the fact that, look, if this doesn't go to Hayes, this basically, unless you think that whatever judge is going to go to, Wills or somebody else, is going to look at that 8-day trial record and not require some basically having a new trial. And that's one of the considerations, is just from an administrative standpoint in running the court system so that you would not be requiring another judge to have another 2-week trial, basically. And that was one of his considerations.
I understand, John. That does lead into the second question,
yes.
And that is whether that's an appropriate decision for the chief judge to make, where the legislature has specified a broad policy favoring automatic, unqualified substitution following appeal. And there's always going to be this tension of the litigant, my client, wanting a fresh look by a judge who's not invested in his former decision, versus the court's administrative interest in avoiding substitution because there's some lost efficiencies.
Well, it's that fresh look that I think, as a former chief judge myself, as a trial judge, it's that, you know, with this policy, then you get the fresh look and it takes up additional judicial time. And that's why I asked the first question as far as the chief judge looking into some. I mean, part of the broad perspective is that the chief judge, if you have a judge who is not wanting to, for various other reasons, have a case, stepping out, even though he or she has made that decision. That's one of the concerns that the chief judges have, is that they have some way of handling
it. I think it would be a proper concern on Judge Sheedy's part in deciding who to reassign the case to following Judge Hayes's grant of the substitution to say, well, if you're too busy, Judge Wells, or, you know, it's not an appropriate case for you. It's within the chief's authority to reassign it to somebody else, but I submit it's not within his authority to basically do something contrary to the statute and reassign it to the original judge. And there's an additional reason, Your Honor. Not only is respondent's position inconsistent with subsection 2 of the substitution statute, it's also flatly inconsistent with subsection 4. That specifies the only way in which a case can be reassigned following substitution back to the original judge. And subsection 4 provides that it can only go back to Judge Hayes if all parties and both judges consent in writing. That didn't happen here. So I think what the respondents are urging is really this court to take a position inconsistent with two different subsections of the statute. Now I want to turn to the other issue, and that is this whole tension of what specific action, what's further proceedings, and the right of substitution generally. It really calls for this court to look at the two rules, each of which defines what a further proceeding is, or uses that phrase, and the two Court of Appeals decisions, which come out differently on facts and remitters, which really aren't that different. The Andrasak case is a unanimous decision in favor of an unqualified right of substitution, and the Ruzulowski case is a 2-1 decision where the dissent says that the majority went too far in denying substitution. Now, I think it's imperative that this court look at the remitter in this case and the decision. It's our position, it goes far beyond anything that happened in either of those Court of Appeals decisions. This was not a specific action. There were essentially, I handled the underlying appeal, 9 different appeal issues involving cross appeals by both sides, all of which were successful, except for one issue. There's only one issue on the merits that the Court of Appeals affirmed Judge Hayes on. And throughout the decision, before you even get to the remitter, there's different directions about what the trial court has to do when it goes back to the trial court. It has to involve itself on remand in judicial adjudication. It has to make findings of fact and conclusions of law on multiple issues. And
on the basis of the record, counsel?
Well, that's an issue. No, I don't think necessarily. There's a long line of cases in Wisconsin which says that unless the Court of Appeals or the appellate court hamstrings or limits what the trial court may do on remand, the trial court should carry it out the further proceedings any way the trial court deems appropriate. And I think that invests, if you look at Fullerton Lumber and its progeny of cases, the ability to either take evidence or not, to have oral argument or not, further briefing or not, the trial court has that discretion. And here, the difference between Ruzulowski, the remitter specifically said, you have to carry out what we request on remand based on the existing record. In Andrasak, it didn't have that limitation. This case does not have that limitation. There's nothing in the remand here that requires the trial court either to take new evidence or not. If you look at the second paragraph of the remitter, it clearly contemplates the need to take new evidence, in my view. And that's certainly going to be our position when this case goes back. It's what I argued in front of Judge Sheedy.
Which part of the remitter requires that?
Number 2, which says the trial court on remand must either utilize the damage figures introduced into evidence or make specific findings and conclusions as to why another damage figure is being used. And if you look at the body of the decision, what happened here is there was only one expert used by the plaintiff. In his report on lost future profits, did not use the actual performance of the company. It did not use its actual costs or its actual profits. It just used a mythical national figure for profitability of construction companies. The Court of Appeals said that's inappropriate. To calculate lost future profits, you have to use the actual performance of the company seeking those damages. There's no other report in this record from which this trial court can calculate lost future profits.
counsel, I didn't find, I wasn't compelled by that argument in your brief that it clearly calls for future evidence, evidentiary hearings.
That overstates, I think, what our argument.
Well, you used the term in oral argument clearly, and my recollection in your brief, you used the term clearly or unequivocally or some kind of comment like that, and I sat up when I was reading that, because what I thought of was what we see on occasion, and that is, look, maybe it isn't the number in the record given by the expert, or in some cases, experts, and the trial court isn't bound to those numbers. You just have to look at the record and come up with a rational process of why you are taking another number and articulate it and make factual findings. It doesn't automatically require different a new evidentiary hearing. Can you respond to that?
No, I agree, Your Honor. I think our position as a trial court here on remand is vested with the discretion to proceed as he or she deems appropriate in terms of how he or she should go about making those new findings of fact and conclusions of law. May or may not require the taking of new evidence, but that's nothing in the remand said you can't take new evidence or you must take new evidence.
Is your bright line test? Isn't that really what you're looking for here? And I know there are different tests that are thrown around. If I recall, I don't have it in front of me, in a maybe dissenting opinion of Judge Schneider, he comes up with a bright line test. Do you have a bright line test? What's the best bright line test that you can advocate here to determine whether or not it's specific action or further proceeding?
That's a good question, Your Honor, because it's something we wrestled with at some length.
Thank you.
And I think there is a need for a bright line test because I think this is a right that should be something that the trial courts can handle and deal with efficiently and quickly and not have a lot of uncertainties in the process. And the parties need the same bright line. And I think the only bright line that makes sense here, Your Honor, is the one that we advocate, and that is the distinction between whether the remand calls for essentially ministerial action by the trial court or judicial adjudicative action. And the reason that makes sense, Your Honors, is that coming from the party's perspective, what the party wants on remand after it's won an appeal is the knowledge that if the court has discretion, substantial discretion, to make findings, conclusions, etc., that the court doing that is going to be fair and not burdened by the past history of wanting to defend its prior decision that got reversed without wanting to base its further proceedings on past impressions, on witnesses and issues and the like. And I think otherwise the legislative policy here that's being advocated about an unqualified right of substitution cannot be carried out. Now,
counsel?
Yes.
That's not precisely how you state the bright line test in your brief. You say not in acts limited to specific ministerial acts, not involving the exercise of broad discretion. And I read that word broad and I thought, oh boy, that's not a bright line.
Perhaps broad is a poor word to put in there, Your Honor. I think,
are you saying any discretion? Would you eliminate the word broad and simply say, if upon remand any discretion is necessary, substitution shall be allowed?
I think that's a better bright line test.
That covers every case except one way. You send it back so they can dismiss a complaint or they can enter a judgment. Anything else is short of that. I have a bright line test for you. Want to hear it?
Sure.
I think that
do we get to vote?
I think that you should really put the onus on the courts. You should put the onus on the Court of Appeal and this court, and that we ought to say when we send it back, and we use words like, we send it back, we remand the cause for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. Or sometimes we say we remand the cause for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. We set up these rules. Some of these are not statutes, they're rules. Some of them are statutes. We ought to just say, does it fit within A or B? We ought to know. We remand it. I think that's a bright line rule. Then we're not going to have any fussing about this.
I think there's some pros and cons of that, Your Honor. I think the pros are what you articulated. There's some certainty there. The cons is I think it does step perhaps on this traditional notion in Wisconsin that trial courts should be vested with broad discretion about how to carry out these remands. And the trial court here, Judge Snyder in his dissent, Ruzulowski, argues that the proper standard of review is an abuse of discretion standard, not a de novo standard, because the trial court familiar with the case and the issues is in a better position to make the determination.
Look, counsel, in this particular case, you had 8 days of trial?
Yes.
How big is the record? How many boxes?
Substantial.
Substantial. If you had no new evidence, and it could all be found in the trial court record, should you have the right of substitution?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the reason is
that's my point. So you are, in effect, saying even if you went through the record and that the trial court who heard the record, that's not good enough, you want a new judge, right?
Because that trial court has to make brand new findings of fact and conclusions of law and involve itself in adjudicative decision-making.
That's right. But then you are really asking for a new trial because no judge, I don't think. I'd be very uncomfortable if I sat on the trial court and had 8 boxes of record, didn't see the witnesses, and I'm going to make findings of fact. So, in effect, I view this as a motion for a new trial, and you ask for a new judge. Why am I wrong?
I think it's going to be a motion for a new trial, I mean, under the line of California cases I cite in my opening brief, because either way, whether it's the same Judge Hayes or the new judge, I mean, this case was tried years ago. Judge Hayes is going to need the assistance or a new judge of the parties in briefing and arguing is going to involve further proceedings in the classic sense. And if, I'm out of time, Your Honor, but just to answer your question, I think the dissent and the underlying case here kind of summed up what, as a practical matter, has to take place in this case. And he argues that even the one issue that got affirmed should have been reversed. But he says at the very end, quote, further agreeing with the majority that the trial court's decision is so deficient as to virtually defy appellate review, and appreciating the inextricable connections among the various issues, the resolution of which probably will depend on the new factual findings, I would urge the trial court to, and he puts in quote, go back to the drawing board, end quote. That's such a broad remand here that it's not specific action.
That was the minority view.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. McDermott, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Circuit Court for Milwaukee County.
Your Honors, I'm James McDermott, Assistant Attorney General, and I'm appearing here on this matter representing two of the respondents, the Circuit Court for Milwaukee County and the Honorable Patrick T. Sheedy. And I'd like to open my argument, if I may, this afternoon. I've got a hearing aid thing here that was supplied to me by the court, and it's doing some good, but I would appreciate it if the court, in asking me questions, I would appreciate it if you turned up your volume and make asking the question. That would be helpful to me. But I'd like to first of all address several of the aspects of the argument presented here by Mr. Van Sicklin. First of all, and he went to this point not only once but twice, he's claimed, as they have in their brief, that there's what he referred to as an automatic, unqualified substitution right. That would be a right to substitution under sub 7 of 80158. And we have said, and we've said it on the basis of case law and on the basis of the wording of the statute itself of 80158 in particular, that that's simply not true. What you have, you do have under sub 7, if the case is remanded with direction for a new trial, then you do have what you might call an unqualified right to substitution of judge. You still have to make the request in proper form, and the request has to be made in timely fashion. But those are relatively simple matters. But if the remand doesn't simply call for a new trial, if the trial judge is confronted with the question of whether or not the mandate upon remand requires specific actions only and does not require further proceedings, you don't have a situation where you have an unqualified right to substitution. You have an entirely different situation that calls for some close calls and some heavy thinking on the part of the trial judge involved. There's another aspect of Mr. Van Sicklen's argument. I'm not going to comment on it at great length, but he did go back to personal recollections of what happened in the trial and certain aspects of the appeal decision. I think these are not supported by the record. I would respectfully submit to the court that under case law that I know this court is very well familiar with, these are matters that should not be considered by this court in view of the absence from the record of them.
Well, Mr. McDermott, is it clear that Judge Hayes did recuse, in other words, did allow the substitution? That is clear?
I think it's clear, but I think it's also clear that when Judge Sheedy had a hearing, which was assented to by all the parties, and setting aside whether or not anybody made a formal request for that hearing, I think it clear that Judge Hayes, that Judge Sheedy was unaware that Judge Hayes had allowed the substitution.
But that doesn't make any difference, does it, whether he was unaware?
I don't think it makes any difference, except what it means is that really when he had the case before him, he thought he was ruling on whether the substitution should be allowed. And, of course, the substitution had already been allowed, but there's no great difference between the two situations.
Counsel, I just want to clarify, Mr. McDermott.
Yes.
That should this case go back to Judge Hayes, and that's the ruling of the court.
Yes.
Will it really go back to Judge Hayes?
I'm assuming.
Or is this moot because of rotation?
Chief Justice, I can't answer that question. I don't know. I'm assuming it will go to Judge Hayes, but I can't answer.
Maybe we
should get that. You could get that information.
Well, I can help there. Judge Hayes is now back in the civil division because I just came from that court a few months ago, and he has rotated back from family court to the civil division, so he is there now.
Does this preclude it going back to him then?
No, he's in the civil division.
He's in the civil division.
Yes.
So it could go back to him. All right.
But this court could, and I'm thinking of the parish or the bacon bar rule, I'm sure that could say that the case could follow Judge Hayes. In other words, as in this instance, in the divorce area, domestic situation where the vacant bar rule allows has the judge, whoever had it, it kind of follows the judge, he or she around.
Yeah, Justice Wilcox, I'd agree. I think this is a situation that in ways is analogous to the bacon bar situation, and I'd say nothing further on that. We haven't argued the bacon bar matter, but I think that observation that you've made is a sound one. As I recall, Mr. Van Sicklen, he also in his argument said that the second paragraph in the mandate, and I think he's referring to the second part of the second paragraph, that the second paragraph of the mandate clearly contemplates a need to take new evidence. Now, in response to that, let me say that when I first read the brief of Findorf, I misread it to a certain extent, and as my own brief shows, our brief at page 12, I thought that Findorff had made a claim that the mandate was requiring a post-trial evidentiary proceeding with respect to the second prong of that second feature of the mandate. That second feature redirects the circuit court to either, I quote, utilize the damage figures introduced into evidence or make specific findings and conclusions as to why another damage figure is being used. And I looked at that second part of that and came really to an erroneous conclusion, because I have carefully, more carefully, I guess, than I did in the first instance, I've carefully reread the briefs filed by Findorff here, 44 pages of them, and I find that at page 15 in their initial brief, they say, and I think this language is extremely significant, they say, and I quote, the mandate in this case does not limit the remand to the existing record and clearly allows, I stress, further evidentiary proceedings, and now I'm going to stress some more language, if permitted in the discretion of the trial court. And that same position is taken again, it's reiterated at page 5 of the reply brief filed by Findorff, wherein it said, referring to the mandate as instructions, it says they allow the trial court the discretion to hear evidence if appropriate. Now, I think it's very clear that Findorff has not taken the position that that second prong of the second feature of the mandate, that the Court of Appeals in the mandate is requiring further proceedings with respect to that second prong.
Well, do you think it allows further proceeding?
My own feeling is, and I've expressed this in our brief, there's no doubt about the circuit court on the remand having a certain amount of discretion. But we submit that it is a limited discretion. It has the discretion, and the statute says, I think it's 80808, says that these specific actions should be taken, quote, as soon as possible, unquote. So the circuit court on the remand has the discretion to do these things as soon as possible, and it's up to the court to judge what is as soon as possible. So there's a discretion there. There is also a discretion, Your Honors, as to what the content of whatever comes out of the court by way of paper in compliance with the directions in the mandate. There's a discretion, of course, as to how that will be worded and phrased and crafted. But what I say is that where you have a mandate of this nature, you do not have a discretion to take evidence. You don't have it. It's not necessary. And above all, I go back to the wording of 801 and 58, and I stress that that statute makes it clear that unless it's a matter of granting a new trial, the only way you get a substitution is in a situation where further proceedings are required. That is absolutely mandated, and I think it's highly significant, and I realize this is recorded, I think, and again, I want to stress this fact. I think it of utmost significance that Findorff has not made a claim in this case that any feature of the mandate, which incidentally, we spent pages 11 to 16 of our brief in a thorough analysis, I believe it's a thorough analysis, of every feature of that mandate. But Findorff, we submit, has made no claim that the mandate sends this matter back, send it back to the circuit court under a necessity that further proceedings be taken. It isn't there, and that's of utmost significance.
So is it your position, just so I understand it, under 801-58-7, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That here they didn't order a new trial, so the...
No, no trial.
Klingdorf doesn't get under that.
And
they did reverse and modify the judgment as to some of the parties.
They did.
Right. So you say Klingdorf does not come under this language. In a manner such that further proceedings in the trial court are necessary.
That's correct.
So you would say only in those cases where it's clear on the face of the remitter. It has to be clear on the face of the remitter because he got 20 days after filing the remitter. So you'd have to say when it's clear on the face of the remitter that further proceedings are necessary, that's when you get a substitution.
Absolutely.
And that if the judge, when he or she looks at the whole thing and then decides further proceedings are necessary, you don't get a new substitution because your time will have expired.
Yes.
You only have 20 days.
Yes.
So it has to be on the face and it has to be necessary.
Yeah, the mandate itself has to be so phrased that it is clear that it's being sent back so that further proceedings are necessary, are absolutely required. And that's not a claim that Klingdorf even makes.
Well, what do you mean by proceedings? I mean, obviously here further proceedings are going to be needed because the judge is going to have to make new findings of fact. So findings of facts is a further proceeding.
I think that we've argued this in the brief. We've said, pointed out that the mandate starts out, as I recall, with the... uses the word consideration, and we have argued... I can't find anything. We have argued, and we've argued at some length, that really what these specific actions directed by the mandate require the circuit court to do is to retire to chambers, sit down, it'll have this record in front of it. It's not going to be an easy task, but it's a task essentially of judicial cerebration. Of sitting there and analyzing that thing and doing everything needful to carry out those specific directions contained in the five portions of the mandate. And there isn't anything, you don't need to go out into a hearing. You don't need an evidentiary hearing, we submit, and the Court of Appeals didn't recognize that to be so. You don't need an evidentiary hearing, and I don't think you need briefs. You don't need briefs from the parties, and you don't need to hear oral argument from counsel.
Counsel, what if the trial judge says, well, further proceedings are necessary for me to carry out the direction of the Court of Appeals? You know, there's an argument that the appellate courts live in an esoteric world, that's only an argument, and that the trial courts live in the trenches, and they really know whether or not more is needed in order to resolve the case.
Well, if the trial court takes that approach, I would simply say that the trial court, and I realize I'm saying this before, nearly virtually all of you seated here have been trial judges, with the exception, I guess, of the Chief Justice.
It's a 4-3 court.
With, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the trial judge is, to a certain extent, then, sticking his neck out for the possible noose of error.
We're looking for a bright line test. What can you recommend to this court for a bright line test?
I'm not sure that I remember everything the Chief Justice said on this particular thing, but I got the idea, and this is what I'd recommend. I got the idea that what I'm going to recommend is somewhat similar to what she talked about, at least. I think every case, of course, has distinctive features. And those distinctive features are going to cause, when there's a mandate and it directs, as the mandate in this case does, specific actions, those specific actions are all going to be different. They're going to be differently worded. They're going to deal with different situations. Now, my bright line test would be that if a court of appeals sends something back on remand and intends to, and as in this case did, simply direct the lower court to take specific actions, then I think after it directs those specific actions, it should add a paragraph. And that paragraph should say, in clear and unequivocal language, the above portion of this mandate directs only specific actions and requires no further proceedings, period. And I think that would be a helpful and salutary way to take care of the situation.
Counsel, Mr. McCormick, I take it that one of the purposes behind the substitution rule is to allow both the appearance as well as the reality of impartiality.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it recognizes that judges are human, judges don't like to be reversed.
True.
And they could extract a measure of revenge against the prevailing party if the judge is reversed.
That's right. That's
what I understand. Now, when I look at the mandate here, it strikes me, and I'd like you to comment on this, that in at least three respects, Findorff is in some peril with respect to the trial judge. The first one, the judge is directed to determine whether the facts support an award of consequential damages. That, to me, seems that Findorff can either win or lose on that.
Mm-hmm.
To make specific findings and conclusions why another damage figure is being used. The judge can come up with another damage figure that could prove to be harm to Findorff. And the fourth one, determine on what legal basis Findorff's offsets and defenses should be denied. Again, Findorff is in some jeopardy. Now, given the basic policy behind the rule, and given this, why shouldn't we say that these are further proceedings consistent with the statute?
Well,
because it certainly would seem to further the legislative policy.
Simply because I think, Your Honor, the test of whether proceedings are required, that test lies solely within the province of taking a look at the wording used in the mandate. Here we have a paragraph of some 10, 11 sentences, and if you can find in that wording that the court is sending the matter back for further proceedings, well and good. But if you, and I maintain, and we've adhered to this position and certainly aren't going to abandon it this morning, that the mandate is so worded that it's obvious that it does not require further proceedings. It simply requires specific action.
Do you concede that if this goes back to Judge Hayes, Judge Hayes could do things pursuant to this mandate that would be of negative consequence to Findorff?
I would assume that could happen, but I'm not going to assume that it will, act in a spirit of vengeful.
But you can assume it also might be favorable to.
That's correct.
Now, I would say that it's not a question of revenge, and I don't, because I think if you did have a concept of revenge, then I think you could eliminate this judge, not by a substitution, but by an affidavit of prejudice. That the judge not sit on it. But I think that the issue is, rather, that the judge has heard this evidence as a result of hearing it, the judge has a particular view towards the evidence, and that's what you expect somebody to have as a judge, and has made a judgment. So the question then is, now, can the person who has looked at 8 days of trial, has made a determination and finding of fact, and therefore has a view of the evidence, can that person turn it around and look at it afresh? I mean, I think that is the issue on this kind of case. And the question is, does the judge have to look at it so afresh that you wonder whether the judge can do that? And I don't know that we can tell that from the remittitor. I don't think we can tell that necessarily from the opinions or even these briefs.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would agree with it. Before,
Mr. McDermott, may I ask a question?
Yes, Mr. Prosser.
The trial in this case occurred in February 1995.
Yes.
It lasted for 8 days. I suspect the transcript was substantial.
I would imagine.
The Court of Appeals was not very complimentary to Judge Hayes about how he handled the trial. You look at the mandate, including such things as the trial court should determine any damage amounts without resorting to tort principles.
Yes.
As though the trial judge had resorted to tort principles.
Yes, he had.
Don't you think it's pretty reasonable to expect that the parties would be filing briefs to help the trial court wade through 8 pages of transcripts on a trial 4 years ago, more than 4 years ago?
Well, it seems to me that this is it's an ugly baby on the doorstep, the judge. No, not. But it seems to me.
No babies are ugly.
I'm speaking from paternal experience. It seems to me it's a baby that's got to be diapered and taken care of by just the judge and not by the lawyers. And they it's really not. If I were the judge in this position, I would feel that this was a difficult task that confronted me. I would also feel that it was up to me to take care of it. And I would hope to be able to take care of it without asking for aid of counsel, much as I might appreciate. Your Honors, I'd like to, just briefly, if I might, before I run out of time, comment on this other issue, and that's the issue, of course, of whether or not Judge Sheedy had the power to rule on this particular substitution request. And we're making the contention, and have made it at some length in our brief, that rules of this court, notably SCR 70.20 and 70.19, did confer the power on Judge Sheedy. As you know, he's no longer chief judge, but retired, but he was chief judge when he acted here. And those rules, I'd really like to quickly read them in pertinent part. The pertinent parts of them. The chief judge shall exercise, this is 70.20, within the judicial administrative district, the full administrative power of the judicial branch of government subject to the administrative control of the Supreme Court, unquote. And then, in further pertinent part, I cite 70.19, and this is an important rule. The chief judge is the administrative chief of the judicial administrative district. The chief judge is responsible for the administration of judicial business in circuit courts within the district. Then there's some language omitted. Then it says the general responsibility of the chief judge is to supervise and direct the administration of the district, including the judicial business of elected, appointed, and assigned circuit judges. Now, what is that judicial business? That's what it is, and it very clearly is, and this court is well aware of it, the judicial business of a circuit court under the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin and under statute. And right now the number of that statute is escaping me. But under statute is to hear and determine all civil and criminal cases that come before it, unless there is a statute that provides for an exclusive jurisdiction other than the circuit courts over some matter. Now, that's the judicial business, and I say that the very fact that that language appears in the rule in 70.19, and then, of course, it must be read in conjunction with the pertinent language I've just read from 70.20, we submit, Your Honors, that confers on Judge Sheedy a power that he doesn't have from statute, we concede, and he doesn't get it out of case law. And it is very important that he have that power because a review by the chief judge is going to be a lot speedier. And I'm speaking of a review of the granting under sub 7 of a substitution request is going to be a lot speedier than you could get under either one of the remedies that Mr. Van Sicklin has mentioned. One is the application for leave to appeal. The other would be a petition for supervisory writ. And it's interesting to note, I would point out before I close, that Mr. Van Sicklin, or whoever wrote the brief of Findorf in this particular passage, it wasn't in the brief, it's in the petition for review, points out that it took 15 months for the Court of Appeals to rule on the petition for supervisory writ that they had filed with the court.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've conceded that Judge Sheedy does not have the power under the statute to do what he did. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You rest your argument that he has general administrative power to do what he did. Is that correct?
Yes, and also that encompasses all the judicial business of the court.
How do you respond then? Assume that this court in 1996 issued an opinion, James L. J. versus Circuit Court for Walworth County, and assume that in that opinion this court said that the right to substitution in any particular case raises a question of law rather than a question of court administration. Assume that in that case they overruled the prior case of Gilroy, which said the right to substitution is administrative, and that the court in James L. J. said, no, that we're not dealing with administrative powers, but rather judicial decisions rendered in an underlying action. How do you get around a case like James L. J. and argue that it's administrative when the language of that case says it isn't and overruled a prior case that had suggested that it is administrative?
Your Honor, that case you're mentioning was mine, and I'm happy to say it was one that I won. But I must admit that the language you're quoting from it presents me with a real difficulty. Further, that court language says, although the subject of judicial substitution affects the administration of the courts. Now, they do recognize that. The exercise of the statutory right to substitution in any particular case raises a question of law rather than the question of court administration. I simply must contend, Your Honor, that, and I'm relying more on SCR 70.19 than I am on 70.20, I've got to contend, and I do contend, that in view of that language in 70.19 about judicial business and what it means, and that it encompasses all the civil and criminal actions that are heard and determined by the circuit courts, I've got to argue, and I do argue, that 7019 and 7020 combined do confer the power on Judge Sheedy to have made the ruling that he did make. I might have run out of time.
Just a moment. Do we then have to overrule or withdraw that language in that case that you so brilliantly argued previously?
I'm not so sure that was so brilliant he argued. I would say that any court which adopted or found acceptable my argument on the possession of this power by Judge Sheedy would certainly have to give recognition to this language appearing in James L. J. v. Walworth County, and would then have to make it very clear why that language didn't govern and didn't preclude arriving at a decision favorable to the concept of Judge Sheedy having this power. I thank your honors for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. McDermott, and I will tell the audience, if they don't know, that you have retired, but that have voluntarily volunteered to the state of Wisconsin pro bono to help out the AG's office and in the best tradition of the Wisconsin Bar and the court. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Sicklin.
But for a moment, we had devolved into a family law case there. I want to just touch on a couple quick points. Primarily in response to some questions that the justices asked. Justice Abrahamson asked, I think even twice, that couldn't the trial court here specifically order further proceedings, which anybody would concede are further proceedings. And Mr. McDermott conceded that's true. I think that trial judge Hayes, by granting the substitution request, acknowledged his view that further proceedings are necessary here, and I think that decision involves an exercise of discretion and should be upheld.
Counsel, just on that, because in your brief you talk about if it's restricted to purely ministerial, and the difficulty is that I see in most cases, unless we really take away the discretion of the trial court, as they review this record, they can always, whether it's further proceedings or just a specific act, order some action taken, some brief to be submitted, something. What about that? Because we're trying to, I think everyone here has asked about a bright line. What do you suggest? We've asked both sides. What about that? Because you can't hang your hat, in my opinion, on you're saying ministerial versus something for further proceeding, because it is just so indefinite.
Okay. I think it's important, Your Honor, to look at Rule 808.08. It's broken into three subparts, one of which is specific action. The other is new trial or further proceedings. The further proceedings is the catch-all basket. Specific action really contemplates, I submit, the statute talks about the trial court has to take specific action as soon as possible, really unilateral action by the trial court, recalculation of interest, a clarification of a prior comment in his original decision, not party involvement. Sub 3, the catch-all for further proceedings on its face, requires the involvement of the parties to trigger that. And that's really the further proceedings that you've talked about, a briefing, argument, and so forth. And that gets me, I think, to Justice Prosser's question. You asked, I think, you really can't tell here necessarily if this trial court will be fair or not. I mean, and nobody's in a position arguing that we should file an affidavit of not being impartial. But you can tell, I think, that it's reasonable for a party in Findor's position to be concerned about the appearance of fairness, not knowing whether this trial court vested with broad discretion to basically redo the whole damage side of this case will be fair and impartial, rather than, as Justice Bablich acknowledged, whether he's going to be trying to protect what he did before and be influenced by that. And I think it's reasonable for a party in the position of my client to be concerned about that, and that's why the legislature has recognized that right. Now,
Counsel, this is your chance.
Okay.
Give us your bright line test.
Okay, I'll come back to it. I think that...
You don't have much time.
I think it is a distinction between ministerial action and any action involving adjudicative judicial action. And inherent in the judicial process, as we've laid out in our brief, as courts, there's been some definitions of that, involves decision-making that's involved the use of discretion, the application of discretion.
So what does your, give me a sentence, what does your bright line rule say?
That a party successful on appeal has a right for judicial substitution any time where the remand requires adjudicative action or decision-making by the trial court on remand, and is something other than specific action which the trial court can unilaterally do on its own without party involvement.
Does that mean, taking what Justice Babbage said earlier, any discretion? I mean, what do you mean by adjudicative?
Well, for instance, if one of the discussions in Andras Act is, if it's just a clarification of something the trial court said originally, or if it's a recalculation of an interest rate or something, the client isn't going to be concerned that the judge is going to be unfair in doing a mathematical calculation of interest or clarifying a term. It's where the trial court's being asked to exercise discretion in fashioning findings. And that's really at the heart of Andras Act. There, the trial court is being asked to recalculate damages, revalue the property, revalue the receivable, had some choices about how to go about it.
Your test, I think, requires the overruling of Rusilowski, doesn't it?
Well, you can reconcile Rusilowski, but I think it's a stretch. I think the dissent was correct in Rusilowski. Both Rusilowski and Andras Act involved the same situation of no new evidence was required, only briefing if the trial court directed it, and argument. And they're hard to reconcile at that level. I acknowledge that. And I think that Andras Act and the dissent in Rusilowski are better reasoned. I am out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen. Thanks to both counsel, and the court will take a few moments of...